they're failing early on. And the reason why they fail early on is that they don't have a place to live, and they don't have a job, and they don't have a purpose.
The Department of Corrections wants to make changes to the halfway house system. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, June 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, travelers are delayed after the ferry Columbia was evacuated this morning.
One of the crew members went back to the bow thruster room, opened the door, discovered the smoke, and then sounded the alarm.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare volunteer, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska's seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message sponsored by Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska's Department of Corrections is starting to test alternatives to the halfway house system in an effort to reduce the number of offenders who commit new crimes after they're released from prison. Corrections Commissioner Dean Williams says it doesn't make sense to keep doing things the same way when the majority of prisoners cycle in and out of state custody. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman talked with Williams about the changes he wants to make.
Commissioner Williams says one of the most important things the Department of Corrections can do is help people leaving prison find a stable place to live.
Without a place to stay, you're desperate, and you'll go wherever you can go. And that's, I would submit, that's why our recidivism rate has been 60-65% for the last 20 years.
Halfway houses are the traditional approach for people making the transition out of prison. They are privately operated buildings that allow inmates to live beyond the prison walls. They serve inmates who have not completed their sentences and who are expected to have challenges moving back into the community. But Williams also wants to try different models. One approach could be based on Haven House, which serves women in Juneau, and My House, which serves homeless teens in Wasilla.
Most of the people in those homes are former heroin addicts or former opioid addicts. So they're all kind of on a treatment plan. They all kind of hold each other accountable. What really happens in these peer-oriented places is that people start to get a connection with each other and they get invested in each other's success.
Haven House serves both women who are on parole and those who haven't committed offenses. Julie Douglas says it could also serve those who haven't completed their sentences. She's the house manager at Haven House. She says other parts of the state could learn from the experience of Haven House's residents.
We just take their hand and gently support them along the way, and we've had good success doing that.
The department has also launched a pilot program with inmates at Wildwood Correctional Center in Kenai. 13 of them are working this year at Pacific Star Seafood's cannery in Kenai. They live at a bunkhouse operated by the cannery. While prisoners have worked at Pac Star for several years, they used to go back to the prison at night. Now they're staying in the community. Nate Burda is Pac Star's plant manager in Kenai. He says the pilot program has been going well since it started more than 3 months ago.
To be honest with you, there's no difference from those employees that are through the pilot program or employees that we've hired in any other part of the state or outside of Alaska.
He says some of the workers actually have more job skills than other cannery hires. Williams is looking at another model to help residents from rural Alaska return to their communities, since there are no halfway houses in Alaska villages. The Department of Corrections is considering working with community leaders to find stable housing in their home communities. Community members, landlords, or inmates' family members would work with the state to supervise inmates who haven't finished their sentences. Williams says the state would pay a housing voucher to the people providing rental housing to the inmate.
If I can support someone back in a local community and pay almost the daily rate that I would for them to be in a halfway house, why wouldn't I pay the same amount for them to live in Hoonah, for example, or another southeast community? If I can find a place where they can be supported and be supervised.
Williams says half of Alaska inmates who reoffend commit new offenses quickly, within 6 months. He says that makes the transition to stable housing important.
They're failing early on, and the reason why they fail early on is that they don't have a place to live, and they don't have a job, and they don't have a purpose. And without that, it doesn't matter what we do behind the walls or any fancy treatment we do. If you do not have a place to live, a job to have, a function, some support network, it's all over.
Williams says the voucher program will start small, with perhaps 2 to 5 residents, and it will only occur in communities that support it. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The U.S. Coast Guard in Valdez is investigating an accident that happened early Wednesday morning involving a tugboat and an oil tanker. The Coast Guard is characterizing the incident as minor. No oil was spilled and no injuries were reported. But it comes at a time of intense scrutiny for Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, which operates the Valdez Marine Terminal, and the tugboat's operator, Edison Schuest. This summer, Alyeska is replacing Crowley Marine Services with Edison Schuest as its spill response and prevention contractor for Prince William Sound. According to Coast Guard Lieutenant Carlos Quintero, the tug hit the tanker during a docking maneuver.
The ingot made their routine approach on the tanker, which consists of having the bow of the tug lean and touch perpendicular against the hull of the tanker. Then it was during this evolution, it was reported that minor damage was sustained.
Alyeska reports the tanker ended up with a dent 20 inches long. Joel Lally is with the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council, a watchdog group. He says it's not unusual for tugs and tankers to make contact.
It happens. I think it was sort of unique in that it was struck hard enough to cause the dent.
Alyeska spokesperson Michelle Egan says the company's preliminary investigation ruled out mechanical issues or vessel design as the cause. That means the pilot, the tugboat captain, the master of the tanker, or some combination of the three were responsible. Alyeska is taking measures to prevent another incident, including slowing the speed of the vessels during docking. Egan says the damaged tanker was cleared to load after an inspection. It departed Valdez on Thursday. The Alaska State Ferry Columbia was evacuated this morning when crew noticed smoke on board after the ship had docked in Bellingham, Washington. Crew members discovered black smoke but no flames in the bow thruster room. Ferry system spokesperson Aura Landau explains.
The vessel was docked at the Bellingham dock, and the bow thruster is part of the mechanism moves the ship left and right, so it's used to dock. The ship had already docked. Half of the passengers were off the boat. One of the crew members went back to the bow thruster room, opened the door, discovered the smoke, and then sounded the alarm to do the evacuation and activate the firefighting system.
The Bellingham Fire Department also responded to assist. Passengers and crew were evacuated and no injuries were reported. The passengers were all disembarking in Bellingham. The bow thruster room was being ventilated Friday morning. Landau says the source of the smoke is not yet known. The 45-year-old ship was scheduled to sail north from Bellingham with about 300 people and a full car deck at 6 p.m. tonight. That's been delayed until 6 p.m. Saturday. Passengers are asked to call the Marine Highway's Bellingham Terminal Saturday morning for an update. No word yet on what the delay will mean for this week's service to Southeast Alaska. The Columbia is 418 feet long and can carry up to 499 passengers and 133 vehicles. The ship makes weekly runs between Bellingham and Skagway, stopping in Southeast Alaska communities along the way. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what happens when you discover you may need a bone marrow transplant?
I was a marathon runner, a vegan, super healthy. The last thing I would think of is that I would be the one to get cancer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by Stronghearts Native Helpline, offering peer-to-peer support and resources for Native Americans affected by domestic violence. Safe, confidential, and toll-free, 1-844-7-NATIVE. This message is sponsored by the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center.
The lower Kuskokwim River is opening to gill nets today, just as a surge of king salmon appear to be swimming by. The timing could result in a high harvest of kings during a year when conservation was the intent. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
Numbers of king salmon usually begin to taper off at this point in June, but the run passing Bethel continues to build. At the same time, the ratio of kings to chum and red salmon in the river is lower than usually seen at this time of year. That means there are more kings in the water relative to these other salmon species than usual in late June. On average, at this time of year, there are about 14 red and chum salmon caught for every king salmon in the lower river. But currently, there are only about 4 red and chum salmon being caught for every king salmon near Bethel. Managers caution that these numbers do not indicate that the king run is arriving in greater abundance than initially projected. It also does not mean that the king run is late. The timing of the king run is tracking with historical averages, as is the chum salmon run. However, the red salmon run appears to be arriving later than usual. The previous opening in federal waters on Sunday resulted in a greater king salmon harvest than managers had predicted. Managers had forecast 4,000 kings would be taken. Instead, estimates indicate more than 6,000 were harvested in the lower river. Sunday's harvest likely means that the federal and tribal escapement goal for kings this season will not be met, and today's harvest is expected to take the Kuskokwim even further from that goal. Federal and tribal managers entered the season with a harvest allocation of 16,000 king salmon, but estimates indicate about 18,000 kings have been harvested from the lower river. Total drainage harvest could end up at more than 20,000 kings. The federal waters of the lower Kuskokwim River are open to gillnets today for 6 hours from 12 noon to 6 p.m. The opening is designed for families who have not been able to fish during previous openers due to unfortunate circumstances like recent deaths, boat issues, and health problems. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The state is working on distributing roughly $56 million in relief funds to those affected by the 2016 Gulf of Alaska pink salmon season disaster. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
The plan is still in its infancy, according to Alaska Department of Fish and Game Deputy Commissioner Charlie Swanton. But one projection for Kodiak is about $11.5 million. That was included in a table which Kodiak's lobbyists sent to the Kodiak Island Borough and was then forwarded to the Assembly. Swanton says ADF&G originally calculated the Gulf's numbers in 2016 based on previous year's ex-vessel values and losses in the Gulf of Alaska. The data eventually made it to the desk of the Secretary of Commerce to help determine whether the fishery merited a federal disaster declaration. And the 2016 pink salmon season in the Gulf was declared a disaster in 2017. Swanton says the review committee could factor the amounts into its planning process moving forward.
They're useful, is kind of a basic foundational basis for looking at the damages, if you will, by respective area.
But Swanton says the money might be distributed differently than the table projects, and lots of elements go into that decision. Julie Spiegel, a spokesperson for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, confirms that a spending plan is in the works, and representatives from the state, NOAA, and the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission met recently to discuss who will receive relief funds and how much.
The spending plan can cover a range of activities in support of commercial fisheries and support industries such as processors, fish houses, or communities affected by the disaster.
The table of projected allotments sent to the Kodiak Island Borough also includes roughly $32 million for Prince William Sound, $10 million for Southeast, $1.8 million for the South Alaska Peninsula, $543,000 for Chinook, $310,000 for Lower Cook Inlet, and $47,000 for Yakutat. Spiegel says the review committee may settle on the spending plan in the next few months.
That report was from KMXT's Kayla DeRoche. There's been another reported outbreak of norovirus on an Alaska cruise ship. At least 38 passengers fell ill with the stomach bug while sailing through southeast Alaska last week. As KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports, some officials in Juneau say they'd appreciate a heads up when there's an infectious outbreak reported.
The Centers for Disease Control publishes reports of outbreaks on cruise ships on its website. But that's not how the director of Juneau's emergency room heard about a recent one. Bartlett Regional Hospital's Kim McDowell first read about an infected Holland America ship on social media.
So I called the port agent to verify if there was any validity to it. And they did confirm that there was, but that they were at a level where they were able to contain it on the ship and didn't expect to have any patients coming our way.
A vessel with a large onboard outbreak, the Zaandam, recently left Juneau on its way north without any major reports of illness spreading into town. But McDowell said norovirus, which causes severe vomiting, diarrhea, and gastrointestinal distress, is something you don't want to be around.
But when you're talking about something so contagious as norovirus, it can really just spread and go rampant through the communities.
A day later, the Seven Seas Mariner called into Juneau. The CDC published a note on its website that at least 38 passengers had fallen ill and tests for norovirus came back positive. McDowell says,
I didn't hear anything about that one.
That may be because the CDC didn't post anything on its website until 5 days after the Regent Seven Seas cruise ship left Juneau. Those that regularly come into contact with cruise visitors would appreciate more notice.
There are certain cases where if they know in advance when they're coming to port, we'd certainly like to know that.
John Neary heads the Forest Service's Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. It's by far Juneau's most popular attraction. During the peak season, it receives thousands of cruise visitors each week.
Every day there's a concern, because whether or not there's been a recorded outbreak, there's always viruses on board these ships as well as, you know, with any large population of people. So we have to take measures every day about hand washing and not shaking hands and these kinds of things.
His staff often fall ill mid-season, he said, so he's appealed to cruise ship agents to communicate directly to his office when they know there's a ship carrying sick people coming into port.
We want to be welcoming here, and at the same time, we want to protect our own staff.
Meanwhile, those who suspect they've come into contact with norovirus should use plain old soap and water. Charlie Gribbins, infection preventionist at Bartlett Regional Hospital, said hand sanitizers don't work as well.
Alcohol isn't as effective on norovirus by sanitizing, so you physically want to lather up with soap and water to remove the virus from your hands.
Last year, the CDC reported 8 norovirus outbreaks on cruise ships nationwide. Half of those were on Holland America cruises in Alaska. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This week on AK, running for bone marrow. Sometimes all it takes is a cotton swab to save someone's life. For a little over 30 years, the National Marrow Donor Program, through the Be the Match Registry, has been collecting cheek swabs from potential donors. But the registry still lacks diversity and numbers, and many of the patients who require a transplant never receive it. As Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry reports, two runners, one from Alaska and one from Spain, have been working to change that.
Oh, nice. That's great, too.
Marcos Yanes really swipes through a series of high-quality photos on his phone.
We have an official photographer.
In one, he chugs a bottle of water. In another, it's raining, and he runs up a steep incline on the side of a highway. The white lettering on his orange rain jacket reads, Alaska Run for Leukemia. He just finished the last leg of a 300-kilometer run yesterday, and he still sounds tired.
Today I'm exhausted. I'm really exhausted because it was 5 stages, you know. Every day I had to run more than 50 kilometers.
In total, he ran around 187 miles in just 5 days. Yanis started at Aklutna Lake outside of Palmer and ended his last leg outside of Healy. He's from the Canary Islands, which belongs to Spain, but for one of those legs, he was joined by an Alaskan, Christy Youngblood. She's a 33-year-old lymphoma survivor.
It was hard. We were cold and it was raining and I just wanted to keep pushing for all those who can't run.
And Youngblood found the perfect person to do it with. Yanis's father died from leukemia in 2014. After that, he ran in Iceland to raise awareness for the bone marrow donation registry. And then he came across Youngblood's story online. They both loved running and cats. He'd lost his father, and she'd recently lost her mother. He sent her a Facebook message telling her about his idea to run in Alaska.
We just kept messaging back and forth and quickly grew into a friendship. And of course, I wanted to help him and his crew get over to Alaska and to make this documentary happen and increase the awareness for the need of bone marrow donors.
Youngblood was first diagnosed with lymphoma in 2016.
I was a marathon runner, a vegan, super healthy. The last thing I would think of is that I would be the one to get cancer.
She finished chemotherapy, but after a few months, doctors thought the cancer was back and that she needed a bone marrow transplant.
I know that feeling when they told me that I would need a transplant. They may have been able to use my own cells, but if they couldn't, that feeling of just being so helpless. And I don't want anyone else to feel that way.
Luckily, she didn't end up needing it. And a few months after finding out she was in remission, she decided to start running again. Training was exhausting, but when she got the message from Yanis, it inspired her to keep going. She ended up running over 30 miles with him, including up and down Mount Healy. Here's Yanis again.
Well, I haven't imagined it about this kind of emotion that I can communicate it, and I'm able to inspire people too.
The Be the Match representative for Alaska, Tori Fairhurst, says people need the same tissue type to become marrow matches. Because tissue types are inherited, that means they need similar ancestry. Certain groups, like Alaska Natives, are underrepresented on the registry.
There are 14,000 patients in the United States searching, and a lot of them are never going to find a match. And it doesn't mean there wasn't a match. It means the match didn't sign up yet.
80% of the time, it's as simple as donating stem cells through a blood transfusion. The other 20%, they're donating marrow to the patient.
The patient's marrow would be destroyed, and their perfectly matched donor's cells would be given to them, and they would rebuild an immune system using the donor's cells.
That's exactly what Wasilla resident Sandra Lynn Hinton did. About 8 years after Hinton registered, 24-year-old Jonathan Leon was diagnosed with leukemia and in need of a transplant. Hinton was the perfect match. Leon's now in remission, and they met for the first time at the end of Yanis's run.
There are just no words to know, you know, the something small that I had in me that I could give to him as a gift of life for him.
Tonight, they sit across the table from one another, smiling, at a celebration dinner for the race in the basement of Anchorage's 49th State Brewery. Leon and his family made the trip all the way from Miami to meet Hinton.
Thanks to her, I'm alive, breathing, so I had to come visit her in Alaska.
Hinton says the donation process wasn't as painful as many people think.
I basically felt, for me, like I just had fallen down on the ice and hurt my rear end for a couple days.
Yanis says he'll be back in Alaska to screen his documentary when it's finished. His goal is to get 3,000 new donors on the registry, 10 for each kilometer he ran. In Anchorage, I'm Erin McKinstry.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Apayo Moore from Electnagig. Moore is an artist who recently painted an 80-foot mural at the Yukon Kuskokwim Fitness Center in Bethel.
When I was younger, just like little kids like doing, especially little girls, they like impressing their dads. And my dad saw that I kind of had a natural ability with drawing, and he said, hey, you're an artist. And I really grabbed onto that, and I was like, if he says I'm an artist, I must be an artist. And so he would teach me how to draw things like dogs. He would give me pointers, and I would really hold on to every word that he said and follow his advice and kind of get coached that way. And then as I went into school, it just kind of came out with my classmates where they recognized it themselves. And when we had to do drawing projects, I'd have a little line of people coming over. Will you draw me this? Will you draw this for me? And it was just kind of a position that I was placed in by the people around me recognizing what skills and values I had to contribute. Yeah, I've always been a tomboy. At one point I wanted to be in the WNBA. So when I went to community college, I was only going because I could play basketball there. I wanted to work on the slope, and I was going to drive rigs. I also wanted to be a carpenter. But that's the wonderful thing about living in rural Alaska, is that I'm able to do a lot of the things that I've always dreamt of, and there's not really any limitations. I get to learn how to work on motors if I want to. I know general construction for, you know, I did a tiny home building class. I live off grid in Aleknagik, and so I have a generator, and it kind of forces me into needing to do these other trade skills that, you know, be careful what you wish for, because you might end up working really hard. But in my perspective, it's what makes me mentally healthy, and it makes my well-being just continue to be able to see things that are inspiring, so my artwork is effective in just sharing our way of life. Feedback that I was getting was, well, if you want to be an artist, you can't live in rural Alaska. And I said, you're dead wrong. I am so inspired when I'm in rural Alaska. How am I going to produce good art if I'm living in a city when all my inspiration is a $300 ticket away?
Apayo Moore lives in Aleknagik. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Aaron McKinstry, Wesley Early, and Christy Schallenberger. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Eric Bork.
Finally tonight, a correction. Last evening in our discussion about Senator Lisa Murkowski's voting history on Supreme Court nominees, we said Senator Murkowski voted on the nominations of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer. It was, in fact, Senator Frank Murkowski who cast those votes. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. And follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA. Want a fulfilling volunteer opportunity educating and protecting your community? As a trained Medicare volunteer, you'll help stop fraud and connect people with the benefits they've earned. You can make a powerful difference for Alaska's seniors. Learn more at medicare.alaska.gov or call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 800-478-6065. This message is sponsored by Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.